You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey you, welcome to another episode of Sex Gets Real. This week I am talking with Jacqueline Friedman. She's been on the show before, and this time we actually recorded it several weeks ago, but I was sitting on it because her brand new book, Unscrewed, is about to hit bookshelves, and I had an advanced copy of it and had a chance to read it. It is so good. It kind of brings together some of the most massive consuming topics and the ways that they intersect with sexuality, from like politics and media to racism and body politics to indigenous law. I mean, it covers everything. I don't know. I just think it's going to be a pretty powerful addition to all of our bookshelves. The full title is Unscrewed: Women, Sex, Power, and How to Stop Letting the System Screw Us All. And it comes out on November 14th, 2017. So we completely geek out. We talk about Hugh Hefner. We talk about how hedonism has become conflated with liberation, especially in sex positive circles, and how we can't like sexual Olympics our way to liberation. We talk about capitalism and individual solutions and how they keep us feeling sexually broken and why the medical profession is failing us and sex ed and toxic masculinity. I mean, we talk about some big shit in this episode and we have a blast doing it. I also want to remind you that Explore More Summit is having a special breakout edition. It's going to be December 4th through the 8th. And it's entirely online and free. And we're going to spend 5 days talking all about body politics, self-acceptance, fat phobia, fat acceptance, diet culture. So like if you've ever been on a diet, if you've ever felt like you had to change your body, if you've ever felt like your body wasn't good enough and you weren't worthy, this is absolutely for you. We have some big conversations, some really confronting conversations, and we're going to do it all together with the Explore More community. So go to exploremoresummit.com to sign up. I would love to see you there. It's going to be so rad. So let me tell you a little bit about Jacqueline, and then we will jump into this very rich hour. Jacqueline Friedman is a writer, speaker, and activist, and creator of the hit books Yes Means Yes, Visions of Female Sexual Power and a World Without Rape, and What You Really, Really Want, The Smart Girl's Shame-Free Guide to Sex and Safety. Her podcast, Unscrewed, is paving new paths to sexual liberation and was actually named one of the best sex podcasts by both Marie Claire and Esquire. So here is my rich, delicious chat with Jacqueline about her new book, Unscrewed.
Welcome back to the show, Jacqueline. I am kind of ridiculously excited to talk to you.
Oh, me too. Thanks for having me back.
You're so welcome. Any chance that I get to geek out with someone as like smart and amazing as you just like feeds my soul. And I just finished reading my advanced copy of your new book, Unscrewed. And it was kind of like having brain sex with you from afar.
Ooh, flattery will get you everywhere, John.
Perfect. Okay, so I think one of the things that just felt like so delicious to me about the book is, well, you cover so many enormous topics in this book. And I mean, you talk about legislation, you talk about sex education, you talk about sex work, you talk about Black women and reproductive justice, you talk about indigenous rights and the ways that they used to handle rape, pre-colonialism. I mean, there's just like all this juicy stuff that you're kind of railing against and highlighting and bringing to light, toxic masculinity. And it just like made my heart so happy, because one of the things that impressed me so much about this was there's this danger, I think, in sexuality to be so focused on just sex and just pleasure or just consent, which are all important things, but you're kind of casting your net so wide to allow us to see that pretty much all of the things we're all suffering from are systemic issues. They're not like personal failures, which is where I think so many people come to these issues.
Everyone seems to think that whatever issues they're having with sex is like on them to fix. And I think women especially, but not exclusively, and queer and genderqueer people, people for whom the sexual culture is not intentionally created, like the larger sexual culture. You know, in the book, I call this the faux powerment myth, which is the idea that we can just sort of you go girl ourselves to sexual freedom, when in fact, there are profoundly deeply rooted and powerful institutions that have a lot to do with how sexually free we feel and how we experience or don't experience our bodies and our pleasure. And the book, the project of the book really is to expose all of that. Yeah. And it's huge, right? It's huge.
It's huge.
You know, I think about talking about sexuality on three levels. You know, there's the sort of doing it level, like the mechanics and like, give me advice about how to do a better blowjob or, you know, those sorts of things. And then there's kind of sexual ethics, like how do we treat each other as sex partners and how do we navigate our sexual relationships? And then this book is also kind of on the third level, which is the context in which we're doing all of that stuff. And I feel like most sexuality conversations happen either on the first or second level. And both of those levels are really important, right? I'm not saying we should all be on the third level. We have to meet people where they are, and people live on a really individual place, right? But I don't feel like, I feel like this meta conversation gets left out, and it has just so much impact on the way we experience our sex lives.
Yeah, one of the things that I loved about your faux powerment piece was, I think there's a lot of people in the world doing a lot of work to kind of point out things around like market feminism and the ways that like the body positivity movement's been co-opted by companies like Dove, who are actually just trying to sell you on creams and lotions to make you prettier. And, you know, we're kind of seeing this in so many different areas of activism where corporations then come in and try and kind of sell us on this brand of empowerment that's not actually about real power. It's about the illusion of if we do these things, then we'll be personally more powerful, but not kind of culturally free. And I thought the ways that you talked about faux powerment and the examples that you gave, and really talking about how we can't claim to be sexually liberated and sexually free when women specifically, or, you know, trans or queer folks, but we'll talk about women for most of this, but when women actually say, here's what I want and here's what I'm going to do, and then they get punished for it, there's actually no power in that.
There's no power in it. And I get why the faux powerment narrative is so appealing, because the other answer, the way to real power, is we have to do the work of cultural change, right? And that's overwhelming, right? Most people don't even know where to start with that. And even those of us who do, it's overwhelming. And so when you've got someone saying, you don't have to worry about changing the culture, just take this class or buy this product or, you know, watch this movie or whatever it is, and you'll be empowered, it's very appealing. I fall for it too, right? And it's not to say that there aren't things that we can buy that makes us feel better sexually, right? Whether that's sex toys that we love, or media that have a message that really resonate with us, or, you know, pole dancing classes or whatever. On an individual level, there are things we can spend our money on that may make us feel more sexually powerful in the short term. Mm-hmm. But there's two problems with it. One is, most folks who are selling individual empowerment solutions are not really wanting you to get free, because if you did, you wouldn't need to buy their next thing, right?
Like, exactly. That's why Weight Watchers doesn't actually really want you to lose that
right,
weight.
Exactly. Like, they want you to keep being a consumer. And so those original Dove Real Women ads were to sell anti-cellulite cream, which I had not remembered until I went back to do the work. And I was like, oh my God, that's horrifying. And now what's Dove doing? They've decided that it's really important for you to be able to raise your hand and be powerful, but you can only do that if your armpit is less gnarly than it is now. And so we're going to sell moisturizing deodorant, right? Like, mm-hmm. They've invented a problem you didn't even have before and are telling you that once you solve it, you'll feel powerful. And so that's one. The incentives of getting free via the market are just fucked up. Right? I can swear on your podcast, right?
Oh, please.
Okay.
Do.
They're just fucked up. And capitalism does not want you to get free, just period. And the second is any liberation solution that requires you to shell out money for it isn't going to get everybody free, because not everybody, you know, economic equality is not a reality. You know,
yep.
I mean, on any level, even just on the level of like women making sense on the male dollar. So it's an individualistic solution, right? It's not changing anything. It's not helping anybody but you. And mostly it's helping you temporarily. And again, there is nothing wrong with wanting some temporary relief from the oppressive society we live in, right? And I buy some of this stuff too, but I think we need to be clear and honest with ourselves about what buying stuff to make us feel better is for and what it isn't going to accomplish.
And, you know, one of the things that you kind of pointed out that I loved was when we think about the money that's being made, and we compare white women's cents to the dollar, and then Black women's cents to the male dollar, and then Latinx women's cents to the male dollar, you know, so it goes down. It's like 86 cents and then 73 cents and 53 cents or something like that. And yet we, by and large, are the ones that are marketed to then be spending our money on things that aren't actually helping our larger situation. So when we go and spend that money for the prettier underarms and for the super expensive makeup and for the weight loss, all of that money is not money that is then helping us to have more equality from our financial standpoint, or, you know, giving us better access to healthcare. It's literally just keeping us kind of trapped in this cycle where we have less money and then we're spending it on things that we're told are important, but aren't actually helping us to know more about our bodies or to help us be able to advocate for ourselves in a more safe environment. It's not helping to overturn toxic masculinity. In fact, a lot of capitalism is actually reinforcing toxic masculinity and violence. And so it's just kind of this like nasty cycle.
It is a nasty cycle. Yeah. Unfortunately, I should tell people up front, I do not have a solution for capitalism in the book. But what I do recommend, and as you know, because you read it, you know, each of the chapters takes a look at a different institution or cultural force that is in the way of us having full equal sexual sovereignty. And I didn't want to write a book that was just all like, here's a litany of everything that's fucked up in the culture. Like, who wants to read that goddamn book, right? I didn't want to write it.
Because it's a
sure.
lot.
And so, go home. Everyone cry.
Right.
So each chapter also features a person or group who I think is doing great work to move the ball down that field in a positive direction in the area that chapter is about. And in the chapter about economics, the one that you're talking about right now, I focus on this amazing day shelter for homeless or housing unstable youth, specifically queer youth, which is called Youth on Fire. It's here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it really is a way of seeing past neoliberalism, and I know that's like a weird buzzword, and honestly people use it to mean like person I don't like at this point, but what neoliberalism actually is, what it literally means, is it's a belief that the market will do the right thing if you let it, right? That the market knows what's good and what's bad, that the market is a moral force, basically, and we just need to get out of its way, which is profound bullshit, right? And yeah. Especially when you, you know, think about these kids who the market think are worthless, right? They literally have nothing. And this space that teaches them to value themselves and by valuing them, it's such a profound restructuring. And I propose not just that we feel good that they're getting this kind of help, but that we learn from them, right? That we learn that all of us can just start to see that neoliberal mindset in our lives and reject it, that we don't have to define our own worth or each other's worth based on what we can buy or what we can't buy.
Yeah. Okay. There's like a billion things that
there's a lot that, in this book.
Yeah. That totally just made me want to like put my cheerleader outfit on and like do fat girl cartwheels down the hallway. But one of the things that I loved so much was, I've been talking about this more and more recently in a kind of a clunky way as I've been finding language for it. And you had this quote in the book, I think it was in chapter one, actually, talking with Loretta Ross, that was just like, that's it. Where, you know, I know that so many people in the sex education world and the sex positive world are genuinely coming from a place of, we shouldn't have sexual shame and we need to kind of undo sex negativity. But then the pendulum is swung too far in the opposite direction where we're, you know, we've gotten to a place where a lot of people are just insisting that the solution is for everyone to find their G-spot and have orgasms, and that all women should be just kind of like as sexually open as possible. And it's kind of prescriptive still, right? And
yeah.
You had this line that hedonism became conflated with liberation. And I think that's such a powerful line where, you know, instead of actually listening to the vast array of voices that are suffering and who aren't being listened to, it's kind of become this, well, the key to all of us feeling better is to just have lots of hedonistic experiences and sex. And if you're having more orgasms, then you're liberated, you're good.
Ugh, I find that argument so exhausting.
Yeah.
You can't like sexual Olympics your way to freedom. Like, you know, some people have really adventurous sexual tastes and drives, and that's great, you know, like good for you. And some people don't, or most people have a mix of, you know, some of their tastes might be perceived as adventurous and some of them might not. And real sexual liberation is when we get to know ourselves and value our sexual relationship with ourselves and our own sexual sovereignty and pursue the sex lives, whatever they look like, that work for us, that we're not out trying to prove how free we are. This was a head trip that came out of the 60s sexual revolution, right? Where it became less taboo for a bunch of reasons, which we probably don't have time for in this podcast. It became less taboo for women specifically to have premarital sex. Great, fantastic, right? Smash taboos. But it wasn't like women instantly had more social power compared to men, nor did women just instantly have the tools to negotiate for ourselves and to stand up for our needs and desires and boundaries. And so what happened in practice was men used the fact of the sexual revolution to pressure women into sex, right? And so they would be like, well, you know, what are you hung up if you're not going to have sex with me? Not just like, maybe I don't want to have sex with you because I don't want to, right? Like that women's agency did not get freed in the sexual revolution unless it comported to this really male idea of what they wanted to women to be like. Yep. And that is so embodied in, you know, all the interviews you can read about what Hugh Hefner was thinking and saying back in the day. There's this crazy quote in there about, he gave this interview about how the sexual revolution is freeing women to be natural, sexually their natural sexual selves or something like that. And he defines that in this very particular way about
yes, he does.
Girls, young women being simple and sweet. I'm not using the right words. I should have the book in front of me, but I don't. And he says, like, we're not talking about sophisticated women with elegant underwear. That's the part that makes me fall out every time. I'm like, elegant underwear disqualifies women? Like, what? And what does that mean? It just means men would rather fuck women who they can push around, right? Like, he's literally saying what I define as natural for women is a woman who's docile and who is maybe uneducated, naive, doesn't have her own agenda, and therefore can serve mine. He doesn't say it that way. He makes it sound like it's just biology. But, you know, if you look through history, you know, in medieval times, women were feared and revered for their fecundity and their voracious, out of control sexual appetites. That's where we get the idea of the vagina dentata from, right? Like, so what the culture imagines is natural for women's sexuality changes wildly depending on that culture. It's constructed.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. There's so much. I think, like, I mean, one, that Hugh Hefner quote of kind of that, like, idealizing the girl next door and not wanting someone who's sophisticated and who also has some experiences and some feelings. And
maybe some standards, right? Like, she
knows, exactly.
She maybe can be like, oh, you're not as good as my last guy, right? You know?
Right.
Which is super rich because Playboy is and was pitched, but even more so back then, pitched at the sophisticated man, right? So, but a woman who had the same characteristics as the men they're trying to reach, they don't want it all. They completely reject.
Right. Because it kind of takes us into that virgin whore dichotomy and that, like, innocence versus kind of the sexually explicit whore, which is pervasive in everything that we're still dealing with, right? I mean, and especially when we start looking at it across race lines and the ways that we sexualize and slut shame, like, Black and brown girls. And just this, like, also this, like, temptation to want to disbelieve women. And, you know, I think that that kind of touches on this whole, like, innocence thing that Hugh Hefner's talking about of, like, if she's innocent and sweet and naive, then she won't really have any ideas about the world. So I can tell her what to believe and what to think about sex. And then that kind of ties into this, like, cultural pressure we have of where we're always telling people how to behave, how to feel about sex, how to experience their bodies. And then we end up in a place where the vast majority of the emails that I get are, I don't know what I want. I don't know what feels good. I don't know how to ask, you know, for what I need. Or when my boyfriend asks me what I want, I have absolutely no idea what to tell him because we have no tools or skills for actually looking within and saying, like, hey, what's going on in me? We're just surrounded and immersed in a culture that's insisting that they know better than we do.
Absolutely. You know, I wrote my last book, What You Really, Really Want, because of that exact thing, right? Because when I was touring around talking about affirmative consent, when Yes Means Yes came out, I heard from so many young women and older women also who would say to me, I love the idea of Yes Means Yes. I love the idea that partners should pay attention to what you're actively into and not just what you're not objecting to. But how do I know what I want to say yes and no to? Like, how do I even figure that out? And so I literally wrote a whole book because I was like, well, I've figured out some things about that along the way, but, like, you're right. There's no framework for that. We don't give women especially any framework for that. And in fact, in the public schools, we mostly teach that sex is terrifying. You shouldn't do it. If you do it, you're wrong. Or at best, we're teaching what we colloquially call disaster prevention sex ed, right? Which is like, don't do it. But if you insist on doing it, here's how to prevent disease spread and pregnancy, right?
Yeah.
And most of that focuses on penis in vagina, right? And what that results in is that we never teach women, girls, queer students, anyone that the sexual culture is not set up for, that sex could be good for them. Right. Yeah. So when you make pleasure a taboo in sex ed, which it completely is in the US, you know, like guys, cis guys get that elsewhere. It's in the media, you know, like you get the message that like you're supposed to enjoy your sex life. Right.
Yeah.
Although they also get a lot of pressure to have quantity over quality, you know,
and constantly raging hard cocks. Right?
Constantly. Yeah. I'm not saying like guys don't also get boxed in and failed by sex ed, but they at least get the basic message that it's supposed to feel good and be fun, right?
Yeah.
But girls don't get that. You know, when I was growing up, and this is still true today in a lot of schools, the clitoris wasn't on any of the diagrams when we did sex ed and reproductive health and all of that stuff.
Oh God, no.
There's no clitoris, because you don't have to talk about the clitoris in order to scare people out of sex, because the clitoris's only purpose is for female pleasure. And so, you know, when you leave that out, that's my shorthand. I always ask young women, if I'm talking with them around sexual liberation stuff, I ask them, like, did you learn about the clitoris in school? And so few of them have, even now. And that's shorthand for me for, like, did you get sex ed that even acknowledges that sex should feel good for women? And when we don't teach that, and then when women are treated poorly by sex partners, when it does feel terrifying or painful, we haven't taught girls and women that that's wrong, right? Like, we failed to teach them to expect something else. It's profound malpractice.
Well, and I think what even makes that more terrible and harmful is that when women and girls do experience painful sex, often they're disbelieved by doctors, by medical professionals, by partners. And so it's then this like gaslighting by the people who should be helping you.
It's such a cycle. You know, there's a whole chapter that was one of the last chapters to sort of come together in the outline about all of the professionals who affect our sex lives in ways we don't think about. And medical professionals are on the top of that list, you know, lawyers and judges and journalists and, you know, all kinds of folks, cops. But medical professionals have such a profound impact on our lives. And so often, you know, they grew up in the same sexual culture that we're talking about, right? And it's a male-dominated profession. And you're right that women who come to go to the doctor with symptoms of vulvodynia, like it takes them on average like a year to get diagnosed. And I think one of the big reasons is because doctors regularly underestimate women's pain, right? If a woman comes in and says, I'm experiencing pain, doctors expect that that women are exaggerating about pain, because women are just not seen as reliable about their own bodies. You know, I saw this also in talking to the sex researchers that I profile in chapter 2.
Oh, yes. Yep.
So I got the most fun thing I got to do for the book was I got to go to Meredith Shivers' sex lab at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. And I got to like attach sensors to my clit and put it inside my vagina and watch porn. It was work.
Which sounds amazing.
That was my job, okay?
Yep. 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 It was for science.
It was for science, okay?
That's right.
But her research is so interesting, both the research itself, which is about sexual concordance, right, which is the gap between the way our bodies physically respond to sexual stimuli and the way that we experience whether we're turned on or not or how much. But also the way that research is misinterpreted, right?
Oh, God.
Like almost willfully misinterpreted. You know, what she found in general, and it gets into much more detail than we're going to get into here, but the general top line that she found is that women overall have a much wider concordance gap than men do. That men, when exposed to a wide range of sexual stimuli, like they're reported how much, when they report how much they're turned on, it tends to match fairly closely what their body is doing, which, and it also tends to match their reported sexual orientation, right? those are broad generalizations, but those are the tendencies, right?
Right.
And women respond physically to a wide range of stimuli, regardless of what they report about the sexual orientation, but they report a much narrower subjective experience, lived response, right?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of theories about this that are super interesting that I can talk about if you want, because I actually do think they're super interesting. But the point I'm trying to make here is whenever her work gets reported on, it's like, women are lying and they're all turned on, but they're just not telling you. Like, no, women are straight. Everybody's secretly bisexual, right? Like, this, and the narrative that gets told about this research over and over is the body is telling the truth. The woman is wrong.
Yeah.
When in fact, like, why is the body the ultimate truth? Right? Like, why is the woman's experience not the most important part?
Right.
And it's because I think that men, and you know, hashtag not all men, but men as a category want to believe that there's this knowable answer to what women want sexually, right?
Like, yes.
Women can be treated as these interchangeable, like, sex vending machines. And if you figure out, like, the right inputs to put in, you'll get the output you're looking for. And it means you don't have to, like, interact with individual women as three-dimensional humans, right? Like, which is, in fact, what you need to do if you know what a woman wants. If you want to know what a woman wants from sex, like, you have to talk to her. You really do.
Yes. I loved that so much. You were like, if someone's asking, what do women want? It's not even a valid question.
No, it's a wrong. You're always going to get a wrong answer to that question because it's a wrong question.
Yep. Yeah, you have this wonderful quote in the book that's on this very thing. And it just kind of makes me think, right, like, if I'm standing outside with a whole bunch of friends and there's a breeze that comes through that makes some of my friends cold, but I don't feel cold and I've got goosebumps, someone might be like, oh, you've got goosebumps, are you cold? And if I say, no, I actually have goosebumps because I'm really nervous, they're probably going to believe me.
Right.
But if I say, oh, I'm getting kind of wet, but I'm in no way turned on, immediately that changes the story that gets told. And there's this kind of questioning of like, are you sure? Right. And so, like, you had this quote of, if we believe men when they say, no, I'm not really turned on right now, I just have to pee, then why do we treat women whose bodies and experiences aren't aligned like suspect secret bisexuals?
Yeah, no, I've absolutely had male cisgender partners who have, like, had morning wood and in general told me, like, it's not so much that I want to have sex, it's that I need to get up and whiz, right? Like, and some guys, when they have morning wood, do want to have sex, but, you know, I've had partners with that and I never once said, I don't know, your body's saying something different.
Like, right. Yep. You must be lying.
Right.
Okay, so something else that came out of your Meredith Chivers section that I loved so much was when she said, vagina is just a space.
Yes! Oh my god, it changed my life.
I know! I love that so much. And you were like, my mind is blown. I'm now realizing that the vagina is actually the absence of stuff.
Right. Vagina, I mean, vaginal walls are a physical thing, but the vagina is just it is an absence.
Isn't that amazing to think about? Like, of all the things in the universe that have mentioned and talked about vaginas, like, when you really actually think about the anatomy of it, we're talking about, like, just a space.
Yeah.
It's not an organ. It's not a thing. It's just, like, it's just surrounded by stuff.
Right. And we could be talking about all that stuff. And also, and this is the larger point she was making when she said that, the analog to the penis is not the vagina from a biological perspective, from a physical structural perspective. The analog to the penis is the clitoris, right? Those are analogous organs. In fact, all of us, when we're in utero, have bodies that are going to develop clitorises and vulva and what gets identified as female genitalia, unless we get hit with this wash of hormones and we're not protected by the XX chromosome pair, right? So not only is the vagina not the analog to the penis, the clitoris is, but also the default human condition without intervention is female, not male.
Yeah. Which,
I love, but I also think makes a lot of people go, no. I reject that.
I just feel like if I'm not making people uncomfortable, then I'm not doing my job.
I totally agree, right? Because it's like there's so much shitty reporting happening on science, and then on top of that, so much shitty science that happens that just kind of like is constantly trying to prove the current cultural conditions, yep. like to prove there's only two sexes, there's only two genders, that men are more like naturally gifted to science and math. And yet when we actually have these really powerful studies happening that show there's like so much diversity in sex chromosomes and so much diversity scientifically of gender, and that all of us start out with headed down the road to get a vulva and a clitoris, and then like this wash of hormones, maybe you're like, eh, I guess I'll sprout a penis, you know, or some version of. And like, I think it's fascinating that culturally we are so resistant to new ideas. And you actually talk about this a little bit in the book too, some studies that have shown this, but like how often when we're deeply, deeply invested in the existing stories and beliefs that we've surrounded ourselves with just to survive, and maybe we're talking about someone who's deeply invested in toxic masculinity mm-hmm. because it felt like the only way they could survive, when you're confronted with new information, when you're confronted with new ideas and new stories and new truths, often instead of opening to those, you double down and dig even deeper into your existing beliefs, even if they've been proven fundamentally false.
Yeah, and that's a subconscious process. You know, it's not like people being jerks and being like, I'm going to double down. Like, it takes active, profound intentionality to subvert that process, right? The conscious process is, I'm not going to double down, right? I'm going to decide to sit in this discomfort and take this in and fight my impulse to double down. It's a psychological process called backlash, right? And the most chilling example of this that's in the book that haunts me is these researchers were studying an anti-rape program and sort of what's effective in getting men to be less rape supportive, right? More empathetic around sexual violence. And they exposed three groups of men. One of them heard from a female survivor. They heard her story. One of them heard from a male survivor. They heard his story. And one of them, I think, just got like facts and information and didn't hear anybody's story. They were the control group. And what they found was not only did none of those groups become more sympathetic or less likely to be rapists, basically, or, mm-hmm. or do things that are they consider rape supportive, like, you know, the idea that if a woman's inebriated, you can do whatever you want to her, or those sorts of things, right. those beliefs. Not only did they not shift in the right direction, but the group of men that heard from the female survivor, when they did the follow-up test a few weeks later, expressed more rape supportive beliefs and ideas than they had before they heard from her. And I just think about all of the anti-rape work that's being done with no testing, right? Like, yes. you can be as well-meaning as hell, but like these things are pretty deeply entrenched, and we need to rely on good, reliable science, which also means we need to have funding for good, reliable science in order to actually know what works. There are programs out there that do actually reduce the risk of rape in a community, but a lot of them don't, right? Like, and some yeah. of them can literally backfire. And yet we just don't invest in the question, right? We don't invest as a culture in the science it would take to really figure out how to do the work effectively. And instead, institutions that do this work, which is usually schools, right? They just pat themselves on the back for doing something, right? They're like, we did the thing. And they're not concerning themselves with whether or not it's effective, whether or not they're making anyone safer, or in this case, less safe, right? And we're just not asking the right questions.
Yeah. So there was this law that came up in a section of the book talking about Indigenous sexuality and Indigenous rights and laws. And first, I just want to say, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but I found it fascinating that throughout the book, you consistently pointed out the ways that Black communities, Black girls, Black women, Latin women, Indigenous communities are suffering without talking about racism. You don't name racism over and over again, but you're consistently showing the ways that these marginalized communities and identities are suffering the most. And I found that fascinating, and it was such an interesting way to like draw people in without using words, I think, that would kind of make someone go like, ugh, I don't want to talk about that. But in the section about Indigenous rights, there was this piece where they were talking about like way early in colonialism when the American government was trying to, I don't know, do whatever they were doing terribly to Indigenous folks. But they forced these Muskogee leaders down their rape laws. And the law literally said that if any person should force a woman, that it's left to the woman that was forced or raped what the punishment should be, to whip or to pay, and whatever she says is the law.
I know.
Isn't that amazing?
It gives me shivers thinking about it. You know, like, obviously that law didn't acknowledge that it's possible to rape someone who's not a woman, which of course it is. And yeah. I also don't know that I would sanction, even if a survivor wants it, whipping as a punishment for rape, right? So from a modern perspective, we can talk about those things. But the core of that construction, which so centers the survivor, right? Like, so profoundly centers the survivor, I just thought was transformative, right? Can you imagine if our legal systems so centered survivors, right? Like, if someone was found responsible for sexual violence, the survivor gets to say what they want to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, obviously I'd want there to be some limits on that or something, right?
Yeah. But like, to me, that also speaks like, not only is the victim or the survivor being centered, but the survivor understands fundamentally that the community is there to help support them in whatever they choose and to help this get carried out. And so I think that also kind of helps with like, I get to kind of really think about what justice would feel like. And I have the support of my community, knowing that they're going to help me to heal and to move forward because they believe me.
Yeah. Now, look, like with modern restorative justice conversations around sexual violence, I think that there are some pitfalls here, specifically that survivors can wind up under a lot of community pressure to be forgiving, right? I don't think that I have happened upon a perfect system in which rapists are held to justice in a non-exploitative way, right? So I think that restorative justice is very useful and has a lot to teach us, but also isn't perfect, and I think it gets romanticized. It also requires the modern ways we think about restorative justice require the survivor to do a lot of emotional labor that they may or may not actually want to do. So I always want to be critical, but just the mind shift of what's possible, I found so helpful. There's another story from Sarah Deer's book that you're talking about, The Beginning and End of Rape, in the book. I think that was the Ojibwe tribe, although I don't remember for sure. Where it was tradition, if someone was raped, to revere them as wise and as a warrior. Right. And that also was such a profound shift for me when I read that, because I do a lot of work around trying to remove stigma from being a sexual assault survivor, right? That we shouldn't shame the victims, which seems, but it seems
so silly. We have to say it.
paltry in the face of that. And it just made me feel like, oh, you know, destigmatizing is playing small ball, right? Like, yeah. We could be reaching so much higher than just like, don't shame people who've had violence done to them, right? We could say, obviously, it does take a great strength to get through an experience like that. And you probably learn a lot of things, whether you wanted to or not, from that experience. And to revere that experience and to say, well, this is one of our elders now, basically. You have elevated status. That also is profound. That idea itself is very healing to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially because, you know, in the anti-rape field, anyone who's a survivor who's doing anti-rape work on a professional level will tell you, and I'm no exception, that most media outlets want you to either be a victim or an expert.
Yep.
Right? They either want you to tell your sad story or they want you to weigh in as an expert, but they cannot handle you being both. And it's just like one of my pet peeves, like that the idea that a victim of sexual assault can't also be an expert. Now, I don't think every victim of sexual assault is an expert, right? Expertise is a real thing. But I mean, everyone's an expert in their own story and their own experience, but, you know, the social dynamics and all of that. But that our culture has literally the exact opposite of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, oh my gosh, literally my brain goes a million directions. Okay. So I recently got into this interesting discussion when I made a post about toxic masculinity. And I'm sure you know what happens to a woman who posts about toxic masculinity.
That was your first mistake.
On social media. But yeah, it was this like, of course, this strong reaction of this is man-hating. And trying to, of course, do the labor of let's talk about the difference between masculinity and toxic masculinity. Let's talk about the ways that like our culture forces gender performances to be in these tiny little boxes that are so unforgiving and so violent if you try to break out of them, and just kind of like the natural state of simply being who you are. And you had some wonderful stuff to say about toxic masculinity from the was it Boys to Men group in Maine? Yeah, that's kind of helping young boys to really question toxic masculinity and actually to find ways to like be empathetic and to celebrate being who they are. And I would just love to know, like, for people who are listening, if they haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about toxic masculinity, what do you just really wish more people knew or would think about or would investigate when it comes to kind of our culture of masculinity?
I mean, the thing for me, the nugget of it is men aren't masculinity. Those are not the same categories, right? Like, women can also have beliefs in toxic masculinity and try and enact toxic masculinity and do when they call each other pussies and, you know, like those sorts of things. It's not about individual men, right? It's about how we conceive of what makes a man manly. And those categories, again, one of the best things you can do is look in history and see what historically has been considered manly. And it's a wide variety of things, including the color pink, for example, was once considered a very masculine color and was given to boys and not girls. That's just one of them. It's very changeable and culturally constructed. And so when we're talking about toxic masculinity, we are not saying men are toxic, right? We're saying this culturally dominant idea of what it means to be a man is toxic. But also, I think the thing I'd like to point out is it's also incredibly fragile, right? That on an individual level, men need to have like man branded tissues in order to feel okay about blowing their nose a lot of the time. You know, man branded loofahs in the shape of hand grenades or whatever they are, you know, like, cause God forbid, like you should want to wash yourself in the shower. Like,
right. With a boof poof.
Right. So like, if, if the state of manliness that those products are meant to uphold were so natural, we wouldn't need those products to uphold it, right? Like, if men being dominant and powerful over women and all of that stuff that's wrapped up in toxic masculinity were truly inherent to men, like, masculinity wouldn't be so fucking fragile.
Yeah.
Right? It just wouldn't. And so then we look at, well, why is this the dominant idea of masculinity that we're living in right now? And how can it be different, right? Once you can see, oh, hey, this isn't natural, right? This is something we're all collaborating to either uphold or tear down. I think it becomes a lot easier to depersonalize it and say, oh, right, we're not talking about men, right? We're talking about this, like, really specific box we try to shove men in.
Yeah. I have gotten into the habit of asking men who are talking about their frustration around not being able to find a woman and how women constantly reject them and how lonely they are, is to ask, well, where are the men in your lives that offer you touch and that offer you affection and that offer you safe spaces to talk about your feelings? And the answer is resoundingly always, well, I don't.
No homo.
You know, like, I have women friends that will do that for me or XYZ, but it just, for me, is another way of kind of highlighting the fragility of this masculinity around, like, when you decide that over 50% of the population, because it's not just other men, but it's also probably trans folks and queer folks. But when you decide that, like, 50% of the population cannot be who you turn to for support, because if you did, then everything would crumble. Your masculinity would come into question. Your sexuality might come into question. And that's just too scary. Like, that's kind of huge, right? And this kind of requiring of labor from women to meet 100% of their needs, which I think is also why so many men need, like, I think that's why so many men are so hungry for sexual connection and sexual touch, because it's the only places,
yeah,
where they can be touched and be seen and be held. And that puts such a burden on the people that they're engaging in sexual relationships with, because then culturally we don't leave safe spaces for men to have feelings, to touch each other, to hold hands, you know, at least in Western culture. I know that in many other cultures around the world, touch between men is very welcome, but at least here in Western culture, that is very frowned on.
Yeah. And then we have, like, the toxic masculinist in chief in charge here in the US, right? Like, like, we literally elected an avatar of toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
So it's hard to see your way clear of that. And again, I have a lot of empathy for individual men who are trying to get clear. Like, the answer isn't just empower yourself, right? Like, it's
right.
It's not simpler for men either, right? Yeah. Just because they have relative cultural power over women. There are a lot of systems and we have to dismantle them. And that's why I like the work of Maine Boys to Men, because what they're doing is, there are a number of programs around the US and I'm sure elsewhere who are working with high school or college men around rethinking masculinity and what it means to be a man. And they do great work. But I think of that as, like, intervention, right? Like, somebody, they've already formed their ideas about masculinity and now we're going to help you reform them. And I really think the answer to this problem is figuring out how to do prevention.
Yes.
So that the toxic ideas about masculinity never take hold in the first place. And that's a really hard puzzle to solve because, you know, we start behaving differently toward children depending on what we think their gender is, like, literally in utero.
Yes.
Gender is one, yep, of the primary ways we organize our culture. It doesn't have to be, but it happens to be so in our cultures, Western culture. And so those early years, you know, there's not a lot of institutions that intervene in the parental child relationship without the explicit invitation of the parent, right? Unless you're poor and involved in the court system, you know, in foster care and Child and Family Services, but those organizations are not helping, right?
No.
They are the opposite of helping.
Often funded and run by the religious right.
Yes, which is like a whole other chapter. Right, exactly.
Right.
So it's hard because you've got parents who grew up in the culture and haven't necessarily done the work of thinking about what they want to pass on in terms of gender and ideas about gender. They haven't interrogated their own. Right. And so it's really hard to figure out how to systemically intervene when children are very young. There's ideas in the book about how to intervene with literally little children in your actual life on an individual level. But on a systems level, it's a tough nut to crack. But Maine Boys to Men is at least moving their curriculum into middle school and working with middle school boys. And they're just having some beautiful experiences. You know, they had just done, I think, their first full year of the curriculum. And what they do is they do their workshop, which is 4 one-hour sessions across 4 weeks, with the entire class of seventh or eighth grade boys, whatever the school has decided. Because then every boy is exposed to the same ideas at the same time, and it has more of an opportunity to take root. I just feel like the younger we can intervene, the more effective it's going to be in terms of changing the way boys think about masculinity, so that we don't have to do all the hard work of undoing those then fervently held beliefs when they're grown men.
Right.
Which is a lot harder to do. It's much easier to do it before they've formed their ideas.
Yeah. And I think what's so important too about both what you say here in the book and what we're talking about here and what I try to constantly stress on the show of like, we do have personal responsibility and personal accountability for the things we do and the ways that we impact others. But we also have to recognize that for the ways that we feel broken and invisible and hurt, just kind of as we move through our lives, like these are widespread systemic cultural problems that are constantly reinforced and upheld by enormous systems from government to religion to capitalism itself. And so like, there's no easy answer and there's no single solution and there's no one way forward and there's no single pill we can take that makes all of the things better. But like, if we can find ways to just kind of sit in the discomfort of all of these different kind of forces that are happening both personally and culturally, then we can start to actually see those little ways forward. And I love one of the things you talk about in the book is like, we can't fix all these things and no one person can take on all these things. The best we can do is kind of pick our spot on the wall of the place where we feel most passionate or like we have the most resources and just start chipping away. And if enough of us start chipping away in all of these different places, ultimately things will start to shift and crumble.
Yes, exactly. It's so easy to get overwhelmed. But, you know, I had this funny experience. I kind of thought that epilogue chapter that you're referring to, which talks about that, was going to be this pastiche of like grand visions of each of the people I profiled about what their ideal sexual culture would look like. And literally, I kept asking these brilliant people, like Sarah Deer is literally a MacArthur genius, right? Like these brilliant people about their grand visions of a liberated sexual culture, and they would just stare at me blankly, right? They would just blank. And finally, I asked a more specific question. I said, you know, if you have a magic wand, what 3 things would you change about the field you work in? And that unlocked a lot of specific ideas. And that just tells you, like, even the pioneers, right? There's a level of thinking that can be too big. And so if you're on a level of thinking, oh my God, we have to change this, it's making you feel paralyzed or shut down or overwhelmed, the best thing to do is not just be like, well, I guess I can't help, right? Mm-hmm. It's too much. The best thing to do is take it a level more granular. Okay, well, I can't change the way sex ed is taught in America, right? Like, but I can find out what's being taught in the school district where I live, right? And see if I can talk to somebody on the school board about making it better. That's just one example, right? Whatever it is for you, that if you're feeling overwhelmed by what you think needs to change in the world, the number one best thing to do is break it, that change down into component parts until you find one part that feels like you could actually make a difference on it.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you actually talked about in the book when you were talking about sex work was how it's not enough for us to decriminalize sex work. Mm. We also have to destigmatize sex work. And, you know, I've had a number of sex workers and porn performers on the show. And one of the things that comes up over and over again is, you know, if you perform in porn or if you're a cam girl or you're a stripper, like, of course the work that you're doing is legal. And yet there is no way most porn performers can walk into corporate America and get a job with that on their resume. Because of the stigma.
Right.
And you were talking about how, like, it's such a small thing, but it's such an important thing of, like, it's not enough for us to be talking about decriminalization, but through destigmatization, it means saying, yeah, I watch porn. It's part of the media that I consume. And here's how I pay for it and where I get really good stuff. Also, I would love to hire this sex worker the next time my company has a job open, you know, and just like taking these small steps of just even being open in our lives and having new conversations and kind of challenging some of these things can be radical. And it might take a long time, you know, to have that change happen. But when we start impacting people's lives, it's like that Youth on Fire group, you know, for those few dozen young people who are now actually feeling like they have value and something to offer, they're going to go out and have new relationships. And that has that ripple effect. And like, how can we in our daily lives be constantly asking these questions of what can I do to just shift the dialogue a little bit? Or maybe where can I speak up where I normally would have remained silent?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Or like, not everybody has to invent their own activism, right? Like, right. Find an organization who's doing work that you support to shift the sexual culture in one way or another and call them up and say, how can I help? And they're probably going to give you a very non-glamorous answer. You know, like, they may need you to make a donation or stuff envelopes or show up at a rally or call your legislators or, you know, like, the answers don't feel particularly magical. They're very mundane. But that's what the work is. It's not particularly glamorous. That's how the change happens. And it's okay if you don't have your own idea about how to change the world. Like, not everybody is an organizer. Organizers need people to organize. Like, otherwise, what's the point? And the other way to think about it also is, like, what are your special talents and what issues do you care about? Like, you can start from that end. Like, you can, if you have professional skills like graphic design, or you're a lawyer, or you can make a website, you know, those sorts of things are always in, you know, great demand by nonprofit organizations or grassroots organizations, whether they're nonprofits or not. Or, you know, have a bake sale or, like, you know, whatever, you know, you can also just bring your own talents to bear. I actually think the most sustainable kinds of social change work are ones where we enjoy doing them.
Yes.
Right? Getting it back to pleasure, right?
Right.
Right. So if you can find a way to help, to do some tiny incremental thing that also is something you actually enjoy doing that feels good, that's going to be a great, that's the thing you should do, because you're going to want to do more of it. And you're going to do a great job, right? I'm so shit at doing tasks I hate doing.
Like, oh my God. Yeah. I will put them off forever.
Right. And then you kind of phone them in or you do them last minute or whatever. Like, you're always going to do a better job at something you're enjoying.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also just want to stress, like, you mentioned this at a couple points in the book too, but like, until we find a system that's better than capitalism, which isn't going to happen in our lifetime, I'm quite confident. There are certainly people thinking about it, but, you know, let's just keep this real. So as long as capitalism is the system that we're existing in, if we can even just be more mindful in how we're spending our dollars and where we're spending it, that can be radical. To be giving money to organizations that support Black families, that support Indigenous rights on reservations, to pay for our porn, you know, I mean, like, we don't have to be rich to give $5 here and there instead of spending it on something maybe that was made with child labor. I mean, you know, it's just like these tiny little places where we can just ask new questions and give a little bit of our energy or a little bit of our time. And when we can't give those, if we give a little bit of our money, then it starts to add up.
Amen. I don't have anything to add to that.
Yeah. Well, I had so many other things I wanted to ask you about, including the delightful section all about the Satanic Temple.
Oh my God, I fucking love the Satanic Temple.
Oh my God, it's so good. And now everybody listening, if you're curious, there is actually a significant amount of one chapter talking about the Satanic Temple in relation to the religious right. So please do check out the book. But since we are over our hour, would you mind telling everybody how they can grab the book and stay in touch with you and check out all the deliciousness that you poured into this? Because it's so phenomenal.
Yes, yes, yes. So the book is coming out on Tuesday. If you're listening to this on the day it comes out, it's coming out on November 14th. You can just go to getunscrewed.com and it links to all different ways to buy the book. But you can also just go to your favorite place to buy books, whatever it is. They should have it. If they don't, request it. Make sure they have it. At getunscrewed.com, you can also find my tour schedule. I would love to see people out on book tour. I'm hitting a bunch of cities in the next month or so before it becomes holiday hell. Come up to me and tell me you heard me on Sex Gets Real. I would love to talk to you. What else? I'm so bad at this. I haven't got my patter down yet. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Jacqueline F, J-A-C-L-Y-N-F as in Friedman, and on Instagram at Jacqueline Effable. What else? Oh, and also I should mention, I do have my own podcast, which is also called Unscrewed and talks about a lot of the same issues that are in the book. So if you dig this conversation, you might want to subscribe to the show as well.
Well, I will have links to all the places as well as where you can buy the book at sexgetsreal.com for this episode and in the show notes for this episode. So you can just click through all the things. Totally check out Jacqueline's podcast and, of course, this delicious, thought-provoking book. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I actually could have talked to you for like 2 more hours, but
we'll have to do it again
another time. Yes. Thank you so much, Jacqueline.
It was so much fun.
To everybody listening, thank you so much for tuning in. You know I love hearing from you, so feel free to pop over to sexgetsreal.com. You can use the contact form, which does allow an anonymous option. So submit your stories, your questions, your comments, and I will cover that on a future episode. Until next time, this is Dawn Sarah. Bye!